welcome to the Cinema Fade Podcast for November 2017. I'm your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I'm joined once again by the fifth wheel, Tim Nelson.
Oh, man. I know what you're referring to.
It's a sad subject. Tim and I recently made plans to see a movie, and he thought it would be great if we could invite some friends, and then somehow it turned into two couples and Tim, and it was sad.
It was like being at a dance and not having a date.
But I really enjoy getting out with my wife, for the record, and it was really fun.
It's good. I'm not down on that. It's all good, man. It's all good. But yes, I was alone.
Yes.
Cold
on the aisle seat, just kind
with no hand to hold, no one to hold me,
no
one to share my little inside commentaries with.
Yeah, it was fun. I got to go out with my wife, and shout out to our favorite listener, Dave McDonald, and his wife Lori got to go out with us too. It was really great.
It was cool. Yeah, it was good.
So Tim, how are you, man? I feel like it's been forever. Do you have a good Thanksgiving?
Yeah. I ate a lot of turkey.
You did?
What you do.
Did you hang back home? Did you go out of town?
I went to Illinois.
Nice. Yeah. I was in Grand Rapids. So
there you go. The Midwest.
It's my stomping grounds. Yep. Awesome. What's your favorite Thanksgiving dish if you can only pick one?
Oh, goodness. I like cranberry sauce now, and here's why. Like homemade cranberry sauce, because when else do you eat that? Like I can get mashed potatoes, like, you know, once a week if I wanted to, but nobody's gonna like make cranberry sauce but for Thanksgiving. So I used to be dressing, and now it's cranberry sauce.
I was introduced to this kind of cranberry stuff that has actual berries in it, like whole berries.
I got that. That's what I'm talking
about. Like way I was used to the gelatin type thing,
like cat food.
Yeah, it's not good. But I really was digging the berry one.
Yeah.
I've got to go with stuffing with gravy. You know, everything's better with gravy around Thanksgiving, but there's nothing like stuffing and gravy. So
there you go.
Yeah. And here we are. It's officially holidays. Got the Christmas music going yet?
Yeah.
Yeah. After Thanksgiving, it's fair game. So it's all good. And best yet, all kinds of amazing movies are finally pouring into theaters. I love it. This is the time of the year.
It's kind of frustrating.
Oh, it is. It's that time of the year where you have to see like three movies every weekend if you want to stay up to date on things.
What you folks need to do is you should save up at the beginning of the year like a little fund.
Right.
And then you just know come November, like come Thanksgiving, that you're going to be going to the movies twice a week. Until the end of the year.
Yeah, because what happens is, all the way up through like October, you basically know you'll be able to catch it on DVD before Oscars. But if you're like an Oscar freak like I am, there's a cutoff point where it's like, if I don't see this,
you're not going to see it before
the
big show.
Yeah. So, it's that time of the year. We were watching the trailers to the movie that we're going to be talking about today, and Tim and I were just salivating over every one of them. There's that Frances McDormand movie coming out next month, with three billboards in... You were like, this is the best writing I've seen all year, and it's just the trailer.
Yes. That's so right. Like, they had like brief character conversations, and I was like, I've got to see this movie. This is fantastic.
I love it.
So, and I forgot who the director is.
Martin McDonough, I think is his name.
Did he do? He did something else that I know.
Seven Psychopaths, I think. He's like, kind of does these really gritty, like, I don't know.
I'm looking forward to this movie.
Yes.
So
it's out in theaters right now by us. So you should go. I'm going to go. We should go together.
Yeah, we should go because I think this movie could take it too. I don't even know that. I've seen like 2.5 minutes of it.
Yeah.
But I get that feeling.
You got the feeling. And Shape of Water, The Disaster Artist. There's so many good movies coming out. There's even P.T. Anderson is coming out with a secret movie at the end of the year.
I forgot about that. Daniel Day-Lewis.
They're teaming up after There Will Be Blood.
I thought he retired.
Yeah. No, this is his retirement swan song, supposedly. Right? I think he's done it a few times. There was one time he retired from acting like 20 years ago to go be a shoemaker or apprentice or something, and the guy is fascinating. Anyway, we don't know anything about that movie except it's called The Phantom Thread, and it's about a guy who makes like dresses, and that's it. That's all we know. P.T. Anderson.
Sounds intriguing.
Exactly. Yeah, but the great thing is we don't have to just look ahead because today, ladies and gentlemen, we have the privilege of talking about a truly great film. And I'll just go ahead and say it out front. I know Tim disagrees with me, which is going to make for a fascinating podcast, but I personally think this is the best movie I've seen this year.
All right.
The best movie.
That's all right.
And I'm so excited to get into it. So our movie for today, as you may have heard, is, of course, Lady Bird. Lady Bird. You ready, Tim?
I'm ready.
Here we go. Here we go. So, with Lady Bird, we really need to start with Greta Gerwig. Now, it's a little difficult because Greta Gerwig isn't exactly like a household name, but she's kind of an actress that I think everybody's seen in something and they just don't know it. Are you familiar with her work at all?
I've watched movies, and exactly what you said was, oh, she was in that?
Yeah.
So I was like, Jackie. Oh, she was? What? She was
Jackie.
In that?
She was like, the assistant to Jackie.
I'm pretty
Kennedy.
Sure that was Natalie Portman. Oh, it was Natalie. Oh, okay. Gotcha. Yep. Now I know. Yep. Who's. Yeah.
Yep.
So she's in a lot of stuff.
Yep.
And then she's in all those this is a term I learned, which I should have known, but I didn't know it. Mumblecore movies.
Mumblecore?
That's what they call, yeah, all these movies that have real, kind of like realistic mumbly dialogue, which is often like ad-libbed or whatever. I didn't know that.
I didn't
apparently
know that
a lot of people do know that, but not us. Now we do.
Now we know.
Yeah.
Well, her husband is Noah Baumbach, who did Squid and the Whale, and he, I think,
boyfriend,
he,
husband,
boyfriend. Maybe.
We
don't know.
I gotta know if they have marital stash. I don't know. I don't care. So anyway, they're together. Anyway,
yeah. And so her husband, I think, maybe would fall into that category. He makes these kind of very quirky indie films,
and these written. He's a screenwriter.
Yes.
Yeah, and he's written a bunch of stuff, and they are very quirky.
Yes. So, but this is the first time that Greta Gerwig has been in the driver's seat, and she wrote and directed this movie. And wowzers, like, what a way to begin your career as a writer and director. So this is our first glimpse of her, obviously. It is for everyone. What stood out to you as we're kind of getting in here as far as, like, her style as a writer and director?
Really tight dialogue,
mm-hmm.
Realistic characters, probably too many characters for one film.
She's trying to pack too much in there, you think?
Yeah, I think, it's hard for me to say what characterizes her because I've only seen, I know some of her other work, but this is like her project. My understanding is this very, very much draws upon her own experience. And so, yeah, so I would say like her style would be what you see here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not a very good way to do a podcast, but her style would be quirky, really dialogue and relationship focused, emotional, and presenting characters as being multifaceted, dimensional, kind of evolving, individuals. That's what I would say.
Yep.
So that it's character development, and then. Yeah, and then almost like there's parts of it that are, you're like, I don't know if this is character development. This just happens to be some extra stuff that she put in here.
Yeah.
So rather than being like really like the typical, like every scene has to matter. I don't know if that's true in this movie. Maybe it is.
You said this movie was 16 Candles meets Juno, which I thought was an ingenious comparison.
Well, it's like it's a witty coming of age.
Yep.
Kind
of that John Hughes-y type vibe.
Yeah.
But with the modern razor sharp edge of Juno. Yeah.
Right. So you have like some of those dialogue. I think John Hughes is pretty edgy too. And you have conversations where in a John Hughes film, one of the things that strikes me that this film also has, and some of the reviewers have picked up on it, is that you have younger children hurting parents and parents hurting children in dialogue. Mm-hmm. And that there's this idea of like, that you have that, like this desire for reconciliation within all that. I didn't notice that in John Hughes films for a long time, but if you look at even some of the lesser known ones like Uncle Buck, which is, who's our actress, Laurie Metcalf's also in that movie.
She was in that movie.
Which is weird,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
She'd be in both of these movies, but that's a reconciliation between parent and child, a mother and a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So she's in that movie too. It's very subtle. It has actually similar dialogue to that movie in some of the scenes where you have, but this is a very likable character. So she manages to make a likable character who's also going through adolescent turmoil.
Mm-hmm.
And there is class struggle in her film, but it's different than John Hughes. It's not so. John Hughes has a heavy. It feels heavier in his stuff. This feels more like more playful.
You know, speaking of John Hughes, I actually watched Planes, Trains, and Automobiles over Thanksgiving break. And one thing that like drives me crazy, same with Home Alone, is that like the house that the main character lives in is ridiculous. Like, it's this mansion that, like, and this is like a normal middle class house to these, like, Hollywood screenwriters back then was like, you know, think about the Home Alone house. There's like 16 bedrooms and then they're all flying to France, right? And Steve Martin in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles goes to this house that's like insane.
Well,
like,
that's because all John Hughes, the films that he makes are all based in the northern suburbs of Chicago in a particular neighborhood. Just like Faulkner's works are all in one particular place in the South.
Okay.
So so he does it for almost all of his films. And when even like The Great Outdoors is like a film that Hughes did. We're doing a Hughes podcast now. But even like with The Great Outdoors, that is that of people from the northern suburbs going on vacation to Wisconsin.
Nice. I didn't know that. That's fascinating. There you go. That
There is, and most of the time they are wealthier.
Yeah.
And he gets into some of those things too, but no, you're absolutely right. Like, that is what he's portraying that, and that's what he knows.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, back to Greta Gerwig. I love what you said about what she said, that it doesn't necessarily relate to her life. There was this quote that I read from her I thought was so profound, is that she said nothing in the movie really happened in her life, but it rhymes with everything that happened in her life. And I thought that was such a great way to put it as an artist, you know. You're not impressed by that quote? Nah. I love it. I thought that was great.
It's I'm like, no, because if you read her biography, it's like pretty much like, you know, if you read some biographical stuff about her, it's like pretty much your life, dude.
Yeah, just own it, right?
Like, own it. You're writing what you know, and that's what we would hope you would write about. We hope you write about, like, the dull Sacramento adolescent development, like, coming of age story, because you're going to have all the right, you'll know the details, you know, the smells, the sights, the sounds, everything.
Right, write what you know. That's what they say. See, even Stephen King says that.
So, like, there's all these pictures of, like, in the Delta, they have these bridges that raise and lower to accommodate, like, ships. Mm-hmm. And there's, like, that's the thing that's architecturally significant in a lot of the cinematography, is these, like, raising and lowering bridges.
Yeah.
And they look just, like, industrial and ugly, but to folks in Sacramento, that might be like, whoa, this is our thing that's architecturally significant here.
Mm-hmm.
So they're capturing some of that. But yeah, anyway, I'm like, no, come on. This is your life. You don't have to, which is funny because it's kind of like she's saying the same things. She's like the character, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, I'm a little bit more than what this person is.
Uh-huh. That just proves that it really is.
Maybe it's not the best version of herself.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Awesome. Well, let's describe the plot and the setting before we get too deep in the weeds here. It's a little difficult because anything I say plot-wise is going to sound so lame. I actually was home for Thanksgiving, and my mom was like, "You seen any great movies lately?" She always does that. And I'm like, "Yeah, saw this fantastic movie, Lady Bird." She's like, "Oh, what's it about?" I'm like, "Well, there's like this mother and daughter, and they're trying to get along." She's like, "What? That's it? What's great about that?" So it's tough, but I'm going to give it a try. Okay, so basically, Lady Bird is about a high school senior played by Saoirse Ronan. I had to look this up.
You're saying it correctly?
S-A-O-I-R-S-E is Saoirse, in case anyone wanted to know.
That's good.
Yes. Great name. But she plays this 17-year-old, like, firecracker who has given herself the name Lady Bird. It was given to me by me, I think she says in the movie. It's her self-given nickname. And she's like this 17-year-old that, like anyone, wants to get out of the house at that age, wants to go to a prestigious college and see the world. But for now, she is stuck in Sacramento, California, in this Catholic school with this really perfectionist mom, played by Laurie Metcalf, who's constantly critiquing her, expressing lots of disappointment. And then her dad is like the polar opposite of that. He's like chill and is like a peacemaker. And she's this senior navigating her parents, boys, friendships, and where she's going to go in life. And that's basically Lady Bird, which sounds so dull and ordinary, but that's not, the magic isn't in the plot, right?
So I was reading about, because the movie, well, intros with like a road trip to look at colleges around Sacramento.
Yep.
And I'm going to give away this detail. I'm sorry.
All right. Well, it's the opening scene, right?
It's the opening scene. Yeah. Come on.
Come on, people.
So they're listening to the end of The Grapes of Wrath, John Steinbeck, a book on tape in the car, and they get in this big fight, and Lady Bird jumps out of the car while it's still going.
Oh, gosh. It is the best opening.
So the idea, like, to me was, like, first off, it draws you into that novel. But the other idea is there's, within the novel, people have called the Grapes of Wrath like a reverse Exodus narrative. So where basically like you're leaving the promised land that hasn't panned out and you're trying to go and get, and then where you're going actually turns out to be the worst place ever. Mm. Like it's worse than where you left. And that's like the story of the folks who actually settled in Sacramento, like the Okies, right? So like that's the
narrative. Book, they really settle in Sacramento.
They settle in the Central Valley of California. Wow. So it's like Sacramento area. Okay. In fact, those are my relatives. So like my grandfather came from Oklahoma during the Depression, the Dust Bowl, and worked in the shipyards. And yeah, so those are like, that's my area. That's where I'm from.
Wow. And you're always talking about the first scene, right?
First scene matters. Yeah. First scene matters. So I kind of look at this as like an Exodus, like it's not like the Exodus narrative, but it's a narrative of exit for somebody mm-hmm. who is trying very desperately to get out of their current scenario that they're in. And so it really connects to me, that connects with the Grapes of Wrath. Wow. In a weird kind of way, right?
Yeah.
Because they're both these like anti. So what they found in the Grapes of Wrath, you find that like, oh, they tried to exit because it was the only options that they had, and it turns out to be this horrible thing because of all this oppression, and it's all these themes they have of you know, basically the abuses of big business. And I think with the Lady Bird, it's like the idea is like you're trying to get away from your mother and mm-hmm. all those truths that your mother holds so badly that you when you finally escape that, or if you do, maybe I didn't escape to the promised land. Maybe
you spend our whole life wanting to go home again, right? And you can't even get it back.
Right. So this to me is almost like, what do they call it? Differentiation. Like when adolescents push off of their parents, that is an exodus of some kind. Mm-hmm. And so to me, like, I think that there is this idea of leaving the homeland and this journey that I think that's why it's a popular format. The coming of age story is super popular because I think that is this journey. So I think this is a story about exiting.
See,
and
Tim,
they tell us that in the first scene.
They're scene.
Like, bye. And yeah. You slam into the dirt. Yeah. And she breaks her arm.
The first scene is so fantastic because it is just so perfectly, like, it's an indicator of what's to come, just how carefully mm-hmm. tight and controlled Gerwig directs. So like, yeah, she flies out of the car, the mother screams, and it goes right into the credits, and like it's just like the perfect introduction to the tone of the movie. And I thought it was a great opening. But listen, Grapes of Wrath is not at all the same plot as Lady Bird, but it rhymes, doesn't it?
Oh, stop.
There it is. That's what she's saying.
Some of it rhymes. I would say, yeah, okay.
Thank you.
All right. It has.
Vindicated you, Greg. I know you're
interplay.
Listening.
Interplay. Okay, that's fair.
All right. So Gerwig gets some fantastic performances from her actors in this movie. So Saoirse Ronan is just dynamite as Lady Bird, and it's something because, like, her last big Oscar run was for a movie called Brooklyn. I don't know if you ever saw that. It came out a couple years ago.
I want to see it. Yeah, 2015.
Yeah. And she played, like, her character couldn't be more different in that movie. She's naturally Irish. I think that's her natural accent. But, like, so she has that natural accent in Brooklyn, but she's this very prim and proper, like, soft-spoken, introverted woman in that movie who's leaving home and is homesick and everything. And, like, so if you compare these characters, it just shows her range, because in this movie she is like pimply and cocky and a bull in a china shop. Amazing. So she's
23. Like, let's put this in perspective, because mm-hmm. you know, we're always talking about Jennifer Lawrence, right?
Yes.
So great, good for Jennifer Lawrence. Keep, you know, what does she do?
She's in Mother recently.
She shoots arrows and stuff, whatever. So
Hunger Games.
Yeah. Okay. So she's a good actress, no doubt.
Yeah.
This Saoirse has been nominated twice for an Academy Award, and she's only 23 years old.
That's incredible.
I mean, that's...
Yeah.
I mean, we're looking at somebody who is at the very beginning of a pretty powerful career.
Yeah.
And I totally agree with you, and she's able to act in all these different types of scenarios. I think some people have said the writing was really tight and that allowed her to just fully...
But that's shortchanging what she brings, which
she does. Yeah. I actually, the person that stood out to me was, she was good, but actually, it was, is it Lori Metcalf?
Lori Metcalf.
She stood out to me more.
I totally agree with you. I think they're both fantastic and they both need each other because their relationship, this mother-daughter relationship, is the bedrock of the film. I mean, it's the heart and soul of the movie and they play off each other so well. I didn't even know who Lori Metcalf was. Now, you mentioned she was an Uncle Buck. I saw that on her IMDb page. Apparently she was in JFK. She's Andy's mom in Toy Story.
For people my age, she actually elicits like a bunch of imagery because she was on Roseanne.
There you go. Okay. So I didn't know that.
So the show Roseanne, she's Roseanne's sister in the show.
Gotcha.
But that show is like one of the first TV shows that was about lower middle class, working class folks. And so when you bring Lori Metcalf in, you've brought in working class. To people my age. So she's a nurse in this. I forgot. She worked a bunch of different jobs in the Roseanne, but she basically brings all of that idea that I have of her with that.
That paycheck to paycheck, grinding it out kind of grit, working class. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's her character.
Right. And then all of the, yeah. So, which is also like the Tom Joad character in Grapes of Wrath. Mm-hmm. There's something about her where it may not work out for her, but it's going to work out for her kids, mm-hmm. you know? So you get this, she's the middle of the middle class kind of.
Yes.
And so you're not going to have the new house. You're going to have the old, you know, 70s furniture and you're going to make it, but it ain't going to, you're always in a struggle. Mm-hmm. That's the idea.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I don't think that this movie's trying to glorify that in any kind of way, but I think that she, when you have that, you bring those roles that she's played before, you bring that in.
That's great, yeah.
And she just does a good job of, like, she's like somebody who's confident that's in, she plays somebody that's haggard and confident and determined and strong.
But, and insecure also. Like, but that's buried. She's repressing that, you know? And that comes out in certain moments. Yeah.
Yeah, I like her character. Yeah, her character is vulnerable, but like the strongest, like she's the provider character in
this.
Yes. She's like the moral center of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a great performance. It is. I think she's going to be nominated for Best Supporting, and I think Saoirse is a standout for Best Actress. So, some early Oscar favorites there. But their relationship felt so real in the movie. Like, I mean, I can only identify it to an extent because I was a son. But by the relationship I had with my mom, I mean, there's just that sort of push and pull where you both, there's this built-in love and respect for each other where Lady Bird knows that her mom loves her and is trying her best, but she also resents pretty much everything about her. And they kind of, her character, Lori Metcalf, feels the exact same way. So, and they really just capture that in this really real life, not artificial way, you know, just scenes like trying on dresses or going to a consignment shop or whatever, just like all of these real life situations, they capture this sort of like back and forth that you have as a parent and child. I love it.
I love the writing is so good because you get because I think this is where like her writing is just shining was with the Metcalf character, because you have people that in the writing, you're like, she took in like the girlfriend of her brother or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like when her mom kicked her out of the house, she took her in.
Yes.
She's like, you don't know how great your mom is. She's so amazing. Mm-hmm. And she's like, oh.
Yeah, that one guy says, your mom is like, I forget what he says, but it's like, your mom is both like loving and like ferocious or something. And Lady Bird is like, you can't be both. And he's like, yeah, your mom is.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like everyone around. But I think in adolescence, like, don't we all have this sense of where we're trying to differentiate in adolescence and we like everything, whatever my mom and dad stand for, or my mom or my dad stand for,
yeah.
I'm going to be the opposite extreme of that.
Exactly.
So, like, for her mom, she's like, I will not be middle class. I'm going to be wealthy. Like, and that, so her identity is like, I have to be wealthy. And what do wealthy people do? They go to the East Coast College and then they become writers in the woods. Yeah, right?
Yep. And when she's trying to impress her friend, she says she lives at this, like, blue mansion house that she went to once. And, right, exactly.
And, yeah, so that, like, for her, wealth is the antithesis, like, wealth and reflection and time to do those things is kind of the antithesis of her mom's life, which is just struggle, struggle, struggle.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So yeah, those are the two standouts, but there's little supporting roles as well. Lucas Hedges is in it. He was in Manchester by the Sea.
Yeah.
Remember that with Casey Affleck? So he shows up and has a little part, which is great. And yeah, Greta Gerwig just gets a ton of great performances out of everyone, I think. And I think she's really written beautiful three-dimensional characters that these actors are clearly having fun sinking their teeth into. And yeah, it's great to watch. So I want to talk about the tone, because one thing that really struck me about the movie was this incredible balance that Gerwig finds between comedy and drama, which I think is really hard to pull off. Like, a lot of directors try it. Like, I used to be kind of a Judd Apatow fan. I'm going to go ahead and confess that. 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up, I think, are legitimately good movies, albeit very crass and not most people's cup of tea. But for some reason, my wife will kill me if I admit this, but we actually had we have three kids, and we had a tradition of watching Knocked Up every time she was pregnant. Because I really do believe that's a legitimately great movie. Anyway, all that to say, Judd Apatow,
you're a victim of the zeitgeist of how old were you when you were...
Yeah.
I think they came out when you were...
like 2007,
still eight, in development.
Somewhere in there, yeah. Right, I know. But anyway...
That's why I like Adam Sandler movies. Same reason,
which I hate.
Right,
yeah,
well, because you can see clearly now, but yeah.
Uh-huh. Anyway, all that to say that Judd Apatow had the balance in the beginning, but he has fallen off the wagon as far as tone. I mean, his movies lately are like start off really funny and then have these long stretches of drama that doesn't even work, and you're like, I haven't laughed in 40 minutes and I hate what I'm watching right now, right? So he doesn't have it anymore. But Gerwig finds this balance in every scene. It's like a scene can be funny, you literally laugh out loud, and then you're immediately touched and sad. Did you notice that, Tim?
Yeah, I think the tone of it is adolescent. So it's like hyper emotional, and so I think that, like, when you look at hyper emotional, that can play into comedy or drama. And yeah, so I just think that's how that is. So, like, you know, everybody remembers probably trying to be pseudo-sophisticate, like when you're a senior in high school. And like, mm-hmm. I remember, you know, going to the coffee shop and smoking cigarettes and trying and like reading philosophy and like trying to be sophisticated.
You still do that?
I don't do that. I've given up on all of that except
Sorry.
Coffee.
Just kidding.
But no, you're good. But like the idea of like you're trying to be something that you're not, and because it's probably not who your family is, but you're trying to be something more than who you are.
Right.
And I think that is funny, but it can also be dramatic, because at some point you have to face, like, you're facing the fact that you are, you're a false self. You're not who you really are.
Yeah.
And so there's some drama to that where you're facing, like, well, actually, no, I am a nurse's kid who, whose dad is out of work, and I don't, and I have mediocre grades, and I have a lot of positive ambition, mm-hmm. and I have a good outlook on things, but I'm like a very regular person. I mean, that's a reality.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like the vision of who you could be and who you are, and yeah. it can be funny or can be dramatic.
Yeah, she tells her teacher she wants to be on like the math Olympiad team, and she's like, the teacher's like, but your grades are horrible in math. Math isn't one of your strong suits, and she's like, that we know of yet.
Right? Yeah, right. You're like a senior in high school. Like, we probably would have identified it by now.
Right. One scene I really love that illustrates this is there's a Catholic school that Lady Bird goes to, and one of the priests there, who's like, he's also in charge of the drama class, and so he does this little exercise with the students when they're starting out getting practicing with the play, where he's like, it's called, the game is called First Person to Cry, right? And so Greta Gerwig pans around this circle of all these kids, like, you know, trying to cry and get the tears out, and then all of a sudden we hear this guy weeping, and we pan back, and it's the priest who started the game is the first one to cry, and he's just like sobbing. And so I literally like laughed out loud, because it's just funny, like all these kids trying to cry, and he's the one who started the game, and he ends up crying, and then all of a sudden he's like apologizing to the kids. He's like, I'm so sorry. And like, you realize there's actually deep pain that like he tapped into like instantly. And then all of a sudden, like, I was tearing up. Like, that shift of emotion, like in the span of 2 minutes, is really hard to pull off. And I thought it was special. And that shows up again and again in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that and then the mystery is kind of like, you know, because we've all experienced that as adolescents, because we're interacting with adults mm-hmm. at the high school all day long, right? Or whatever.
Yep.
And you can see that, And in this movie, you get the, I think we all got these little hints about the adults that we were around. Oh, you know, mm-hmm. And I think that you get those hints here. And now that, I mean, it's a rated R movie. It's geared toward college set and beyond. Mm. And so I think it's for people that would understand that those hints are leading to something. So with the priest, that's the drama teacher. Like there's obviously some deep pain that he's going through. You know, we can only speculate what that's about, but it's causing him huge amounts of distress. And then the kids are distressed too, because he has to get replaced.
Yeah. By the football coach.
Yeah.
Who's drawing plays for the scenes on the, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So yeah, it's kind of funny. So some of the adults are even like outside of their best selves, right? Uh-huh. It's like outside of who they're writing. Like this guy should never, the JV football coach should never be doing the plays.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a bad fit. But that's funny, right?
Uh-huh.
In the same way, it's funny when she pretends to be a rich kid.
Yeah.
And pretends to have social, like she tries to do like social commentary and talk about history, and like she can't, that's not her thing,
right?
That's not, she's not gonna be capable of doing that.
I like,
so it comes off funny.
Gerwig, she's, the movie takes place, I don't know, I think it starts in 2001 or something, like
two or three,
yeah, it's like going through the Iraq war, and like everyone, you know, there's all these scenes of her, like, you know, people watching TVs as the Iraq war is going on, and then like, yeah, she'll have these pseudo intellectual conversations, and like this, her boyfriend will be like, yeah, but it's terrible what's happening in the war, like, as to poo-poo her, like, her emotions, and she'll be like, both can be sad.
Yeah, that's right.
I love that line. Yeah, it, hey, by the way, I wanted to say, in before we jump off of characters, is that I know that, like, most millennials are huge into the Enneagram. And
oh, no.
I know, here we go.
How
Tim,
many podcasts
go ahead
is going to make it in
get
here?
A, get a cup of coffee for this one. But if you're, what really stood out to me as a lover of the Enneagram is that I think that Lady Bird's mom is a one on the Enneagram, and that her dad is a nine, and you see that like one perfectionist like character in her mom mixed with that nine dad who just always wants to keep the peace in the house, and I thought that was fascinating. And so yeah, look into that if you're a big fan. Sorry. So Tim, what, yeah, go ahead.
John, you should start a website about the Enneagram of all the characters and everything.
I love, like, it. I'm just noticing it everywhere I go now. Once you start, you can't stop.
Oh, man. I don't think I'm going to start.
Well, I'm a six and you're an eight, right? So
oh, man.
Take that as you will, people.
I'm going to write some characters and I'll just base it on Enneagram.
All right.
So you were talking about Iraq War.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to identify with some of the stuff because I didn't. You did, but I didn't go through adolescence. I went through that like before all that.
Mm-hmm. I was in 10th grade when 9/11 happened.
Right. Yeah. So I went through all, like, you know, all this major kind of adulting mm-hmm. stuff happened. Like, I guess, you know, 2001, I was 23 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So like 9/11, like I was thoroughly an adult by then. Right.
Right. Yep.
And so I don't have that same relationship with Iraq or with 9/11 or with that. I think that somebody who was an adolescent and saw that as shaking their world.
Yep. Those are the formative incidents of our life. Yeah.
Right. And so if you experience that younger, I think it has more impact on you. And of course it impacted our country, but what I would say is, like, for kids, it would have been probably more so.
Mm-hmm.
So I see that as something that, yeah, it's in the background of the film, and I know some of the reviewers have picked up on that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, as a older viewer, I don't, like, it doesn't stand out to me as much probably as it does to you.
It did, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I remember, like, I was in computer class when 9/11 happened, and then we were in another class and we actually saw the second tower get hit live. And I just remember, I'll never forget streaming into the hallways, like, as a, you know, a 10th grader with, like, everyone going to their lockers, and we all thought, I mean, this is basically the end of the world. Like, that's what it felt like to us, that everything was falling apart. And, yeah.
So, like, what's funny, not funny, there's nothing funny about that, but what I think is odd is that this film is so, it deals with, I think some people have talked about the solipsism of the main character. So it's all about her.
Can you define that word?
So it's like somebody who sees the universe revolves around them.
Yes. Okay,
so they're center of everything. And so, like, the solipsism of that main character, and then contrasted with, like, this idea of this corporate, like, our whole society is under attack, yep. Or that there might be something more than, like, there's the idea of, like, a collective conscious is, like, kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just even the shot of her in all of her drama and all of her, like, trying to manipulate everybody and everything, and then just laying on the couch kind of with her hand, you know, in her cheek board watching the Iraq war coverage. I mean, that right there is just a very deliberate, striking comparison. Yeah.
Yeah. So that, and I think it's cool. That's like adolescence, like how you could be so self-absorbed and at the same time be moved by something that in some ways doesn't have anything to do with you. And yeah, so I think that's, I just felt like she did a good job of capturing an adolescent, kind of the spirit of an adolescent there.
So let's dive in to the heart of the movie. What themes really grabbed you as you were watching Lady Bird?
So I talked about Exodus earlier in the podcast. Mm-hmm. So I think there's this theme of Exodus and the theme of, that you cannot escape your roots no matter who you are.
Yeah.
And so if you have certain roots, you can struggle to get away from those. But the things that form you are not going to be things that you can run away from. I think the idea, a quest for something that's better than who you are, or a state that's better than who you are. So this idea of this dynamic existence where we are always seeking to be something more than who we are. Mm-hmm. So we try on different identities and stuff like that. I think that's part of that.
And she comes, like, she's literally on the wrong side of the tracks. That's how she describes it to people. Her boyfriend thought it was a metaphor, but she realized that she was actually on the side of the railroad tracks.
But, it is a metaphor. Yeah, but yeah, a metaphor, she, like, physically was, yeah.
But what's interesting, too, about that whole class warfare that you brought up with the first scene and Steinbeck and everything is that the people who actually have any depth in the movie are the ones who are struggling, like her friend who deals with depression and her mom and her dad and like the shallowest, like, characters are the people who are in the
totally disagree
status.
With you on this.
Okay, no, go for it. It's great.
So it's so funny because, like, her wealthy boyfriend, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She is, like, totally interested. She wants him to like want to have sex with her, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
So she's obsessed with his desire for her. But his dad is dying.
Hmm.
Like, he's dying in the front room while they're messing around upstairs, and she can't figure out why he's disinterested in her.
He was dying? I thought he was taking a nap. I totally didn't pick this up.
He had cancer.
Wow.
So, like, it's so funny because at first you're like, oh, it's these rich, shallow people. And yeah. I'm like, well, she's trying on this identity of being the rich guy's girlfriend and wants him to have all this desire for her while his father's dying.
Yeah.
Like, right in the, like, downstairs and you know, from where she's at, he's on oxygen.
Yeah. Okay.
And, like, who's the shallow one?
Yeah.
But I think it's part of adolescence is being so focused on yourself that you don't see this bigger picture.
Right.
Or even like her wealthy friend, like, is way more accepting of her than she is of herself. So, which is kind of weird, right?
Yeah. But her best friend is the one she returns to that actually has, you know, and there's definitely a 90 difference between her and the rich girl she's trying to impress. But, yeah, I see where you're coming
from. Well, I think it's because I think we tend to probably jump to, like, I think the film is saying, like, hey, yes, there are certain things that are going to be different from wealthy people to people who, because they do point out, well, this guy is, like, basically the socialist, but, you know, but dad really wanted me to go to school. You know, dad's dying, but dad really wanted me to go to the private school. So I'm going to, like, show him respect and go do that.
Mm.
And drive the BMW. And, mm-hmm. you know, so he's doing all those things, but he also is, like, reading Howard Zinn. So he also, as an adolescent, is a contradiction.
Yeah.
So I think as part of every one of those adolescents is a contradiction. So, like, even the really wealthy girl who seems to be snobbing, too good for everybody,
mm-hmm.
has absolutely no problem with where she lives.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, well, this is where you live? Okay.
Yeah. It wasn't a big deal where she lived. It was a big deal that she lied about it. Yeah.
Right. And she did lie about it. And that was a big deal. So
that's good. No, you're right. It just proves there's more depth to those characters than just the stereotype that we kind of want to jump to of the rich, shallow kids. Yeah.
But she does jump out of that car, too.
Ah, yeah.
There's a lot of jumping out of cars.
Yes.
And jumping in cars, too. Mm-hmm. That's like jumping in and out of cars in this movie is like a big,
it's a big
theme.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like when her, it doesn't work out with the love interest, mm-hmm. she jumps into her mom's car.
Yes.
And in like bookends when she jumps out.
Uh-huh. I love it. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And they have a really touching moment there.
Yeah. Yeah. She gets comforted and she's like, can't escape.
And there's that one scene with her mom, you know, where she has that kind of harsh interaction with Lady Bird, and then she's driving around, and that's such a great scene for
alone?
That character. Alone.
Yeah.
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 Right.
So there's this like shotgun kind of thing going on here, right?
So many things stood out to me, but there's just a little bit of Lady Bird in all of us, at least in me. I was a punk when I was 17, man. Like, I took my mom to the ringer. You know, it was just me and her. And I just thought she was dragging me down at every turn, right? And I remember I was just so cocky back then. I thought I knew everything. I remember there was one time, literally, we were arguing in the kitchen about something. I think it was about driving somewhere or whatever. And I just started laughing because I was just cocky, you know, and I was like, think you're a joke. And she got so frustrated because she'd been talking to me for like an hour. She took a plate and she slammed it down on the ground. I doubt she even remembers this, but like it just shattered. And she just did it out of sheer, like, I can't break through to you, right?
Right, because teenagers are pain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I totally identify with that. And then you go to college and after like 2 years, you come back and you're like, wow, I would give anything to just have this be my life again. And, so I think that's a really powerful dynamic. And Lady Bird's mom is this really tough woman and ultra perfectionist and judgmental. But like we see that she has roots too, right? Like her mom, she says her mom was an alcoholic and was abusive and stuff. So there's no question that her mom is always like nitpicking herself, but she's got her issues too. But the thing is that what I thought was really compelling was there's this really deep law grace element in the movie. So I think though her mom, though we feel for her because she has these issues coming from a place that she couldn't control, she still is the one who's always harping on Lady Bird, always like shaming her, always kind of saying, you know, why would you do that? And so that just drives her farther away and it builds a resentment in deeper. But like there's all these other people around her that are showing her grace and kind of planting these seeds of grace that I thought was really cool. Like her dad, you know, comes in on her birthday with a little muffin and a candle. I think her mom just like either forgot or like they were having a fight and she didn't want to acknowledge it was her birthday. Her dad comes in and there's like the nuns. Like she does a practical joke on one of the nuns and puts "just married to Jesus" on the back of the car, right? And the nun could have flipped out and suspended her from school, but she laughs about it and she says, "Actually, I've been married to Jesus for like 20 years." And right then, it's like it diffuses the whole situation because the thing about grace is that we don't actually, generally, most of the time, we know when we've done something wrong. We don't really need someone to put a mirror up to it and say, "You're an idiot." We know it. And just that interaction with the nun, like, makes her, like, I think in that moment she realizes, wow, that was a really awful thing to do, and yet they are able to move forward. And so I just love the little pockets of grace because when it matters, in the end, and I won't give anything away, but when Lady Bird reaches her lowest point, she finds the church again, right? And I think that happened because there were people in her life that weren't like her mom, that didn't shame her, that showed her the love of Christ that he shows us all the time, this unconditional grace again and again and again. And that's what she turns to God in the end. And she even defends God at the debate with this college kid. And I think it's because those people showed her that grace. And that's what I think our job is as Christians too.
Yeah. I think it gets into like what drew her. So she gets drawn into the church. So she, you know, I don't know if that ending matters. I don't know how much it matters because it's hard to know with this like kind of meandering plot.
Yeah.
But I guess at the end of the, you know, when you've tried to escape the most is when you find that's where you long for home.
Yeah.
And so, she's achieved her exodus. And then the first thing is she realizes that she needs her home. And so she finds that in the, you know, people who are singing, there's a choir singing in the Catholic church. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, she's like, I'm not even Catholic. I didn't, you know, I just go to the school for the academics or whatever,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And her mom's working like double shifts so she can go to the that really good school and mm-hmm. all this.
And we think she doesn't care. She's literally popping the communion wafers with her friend, right? Like,
right. Yeah. So she's, oh, they haven't been consecrated. We're good to go. So they're very, she's sacrilegious in the context of it.
Right.
But then she's highly religious when she needed it.
Mm.
And so, meaning like she needed some, she needed, in some ways, like, I don't know I don't know if the church is more actually a symbol of her mother than it is like the church. Home.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, this is home. I know this. This is the familiar in the midst of everything that's not. So I don't know. It's, yeah, those are interesting as far as the metaphors and stuff. Cause I don't see her as particularly religious in any way. I see that as is returning to customs, habits, traditions.
Maybe. Although that conversation she has with that kid where, like, you know, he basically is like chiding her for believing in God. And she's like, she says that great line where she's like, we basically call each other by names that were given to us by our parents, but it's ridiculous to believe in God, you know?
Right.
I love that. And I don't know. I disagree with you a little bit there. I totally get the home analogy, but I really think that there is a connection that she realizes she has and didn't even know that she had. And she finds it when she reaches death's door, basically. And I think that's the power of grace. You know, like one thing I was, with, you know, Paul in Romans where he says, should we go on sinning so that grace may increase? You know, that's what everyone runs to when they like, you have a person like Lady Bird. They're like, well, you can't enable her, right? You need to be like her mom. You need to like show her that she's being a punk. And my whole point with Paul is like, the fact that he gets to that point where he says, should we go on sinning, shows just how radical his view of God's grace is.
I feel like I'm not disagreeing with your Pauline interpretations. I feel like you've gone a little bit dichotomous with her mom versus her dad.
Okay.
Because I see her mom as actually being the figure that is highly regarded in this film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
With all of her eccentricities, her quirks, all of her brokenness. So I see her as being like, that the line that I see is, you know, where she's talking to the nun and she says, oh, I can see you love Sacramento. Well, I pay attention. And then she says, well, you know, that's paying attention is kind of like love or something like that.
Yep.
Her mom, like, so you think about that line, right?
Love is paying attention.
Love is paying attention to something. And you see that like with her mom her mom knows if like there's a towel out of place in her room. Mm. You know what I mean? And so I don't see her mom as judgmental, although she can be. I see your mom as paying a great deal of attention, having a disagreement with her. Like, and I think her desire to have her not leave Sacramento is more about her desire to have her close to home, right?
Yeah.
So I don't want you to go on this exodus. I will go on this exodus and I will make it happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see her mom as being an unloving character or ungraceful. I see her as actually having quite a bit of grace. But I do think it's a realistic portrayal of adolescent disagreement with a parent figure. Yep. That's a real disagreement.
And it's hard for her mom to show what she's really feeling inside, right? She's used to putting on a tough skin. And probably a lot of that came from her own alcoholic, abusive mother, right? But like, you're right. The film is very sympathetic toward her. And that scene that we were talking about of her alone in the car, I think is just so powerful because, you know, she was putting on that front with Lady Bird. And then we see it all break down in real time with the camera just on her face for like 5 minutes. And it ripped my heart out.
It's interesting because like everybody has this dream, like everybody that is dependent upon this mom figure has a dream for something. So you have like even the couple that is like basically living for free at their house, her son and then the love interest of her son, they went to Berkeley. Like they could go get like real jobs. He does, I think, in the film.
Yeah.
But like they could be supporting her, but she's working double shifts to support their dream because they have some kind of alternative dream that like, cause they're kind of, you know, still in adolescence also. The dad seems like he's dealing with some pretty severe depression.
Right.
Her husband. And so she, instead of him, you know, he's a software developer and it's in 2003. Like he should be like, and he has an MBA. He should be at like the top of his game. And they're in Sacramento, right?
Yeah.
But he's not. He's not. I mean, he's unemployed. Yeah. So like her, all of his ideas for himself and her ideas for herself are all crashed down. Her dream, her identity is like basically now she has to work double shifts with crazy people, and then she goes home and there's somebody that has mental illness,
and that's
then
her life.
And her daughter is deluded about her identity too.
Yeah.
So like she's really like in some ways
the unsung hero of the movie.
I think so. And like I look at she suffers so that others can dream.
Wow.
And she's responsible so that others can be irresponsible. And so I look at her figure as being and yes, she does have like, it does put her on edge, but her figure is like the ultimate realistic, truthful figure. But because she has to be responsible all the time, she pushes her emotions down. So that's like where I think the judge, when you go like, what is the harsh edge for her? I said, is that she cannot emotionally express herself.
Yeah.
Anyway,
that's,
so
no,
I have
that's
a different, a little bit of a different interpretation. Of
Thank
her.
You for, that's great. Yeah. So the ending, now I have heard some criticism about the ending. I am the king of hating non-endings. Like, you know this. I've talked about this. Like, when a movie just ends, I think it is the biggest cop-out. I've had that one Coen Brothers movie. I still am mad about it. Where, like, was like, what was that movie? Like, A Single Man or something like that. I don't know. But, like, it just ends with a tornado in the background, and then it's, like, credits, right? With that, about the...
Yeah, what's it called? It's a Something Man.
Something Man. A Serious Man.
Serious Man.
Yeah. I'm still mad about that, but I do not think this was a non-ending. I think this movie ends at the perfect place with two words that I came to when I grew up and that I think is the perfect end to Lady Bird's arc, and that is thank you. I don't think you could end it any better than that. What do you think about the ending?
All right, so this is going to get weird. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
So do you know how the Grapes of Wrath ends?
I don't know.
It ends with... the Rose of Sharon, who, anyway, he ends with this, basically a man who is, they've done their, completed their exodus, right? The family, the Jode family.
Yes.
To California, and a bunch of people died along the way, and it's like, it didn't turn out how it should be, and everyone's like really suffering. And it ends, like, they go into a barn, and the woman who is, she miscarried her baby because she was, I guess, malnourished or something, but she's, but there's a guy who's dying. In the barn, they find him, and he's like, he's dying of starvation. And she actually, this gets really strange, but she breastfeeds him.
What?
That's the end of that book.
Wow.
So it's like he comes back to mom in some kind of way. So like, it's a super weird one. I don't know if you want to have this in your podcast, but the idea is like this Steinbeck, I don't know what Steinbeck was thinking here, but the idea of drawing back is that like, you're coming back to like some kind of idea of like, families that this thing that is, looks weak and destroyed and not like where you could have a source of life actually still is the very source of life.
Yes.
And so that there's a strength even in the people who are battered down and who have lost everything and who are, that is still the strength. And so I see her in, which is like the weirdest, cause you talk about weird endings. That is the weirdest freaking ending to a book ever.
Yeah, totally.
And that's the end. You're like, what?
That's bizarre. Yeah.
Yeah. It's super weird.
Yeah.
But in this movie, she returns to mom too.
Yeah.
And the idea being like, it's like when she goes into the church, after all the hardship, you know, like her exodus, she goes into the church and then she makes a phone call.
Yeah.
But the idea is like, even after she's successfully done what she thought she could do and like become who she's supposed to be and did all the hard things, her source is still her mom.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting. That's so beautiful. Super weird.
Yeah.
But that's how, but I don't think it's disconnected really.
At least it didn't end with her mom nursing her or something.
Yeah, that would be really... I don't want to get into all that.
But I think I know we'd have a problem with the ending, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. But I think, you know, Steinbeck isn't... You know, I think he's really... It's as weird as that is. I don't think... You don't have that in the film, I don't believe.
No, thankfully. So you agree that it's the right way to end?
Yeah, because I think the film is about the strength of your roots. Even if you're from Sacramento,
yeah,
which is like in the scheme of all cities is like, or from Milwaukee, it's pretty down, you know, down there. Or if you're middle of the road grades and all this, but your real strength is your family and your traditions and the things that you came out of, no matter how humble. or middle of the road,
mm-hmm.
Those things matter.
Mm-hmm.
And they're your source.
Hey, by the way, I saw in Time Magazine that they have...
Koch Brothers on?
No. No, they've got... they were doing tech inventions, and this year they invented a portable breastfeeding pump. You just put it right under your
shirt. I never thought that we were going here.
Portable. I just wish that I had tracked them down as a sponsor if I knew that we were going to be spending this much time talking about it. It would have been fantastic.
Oh, we're going to get in trouble from some listeners. I don't know.
It's portable, and it goes into a freezer bag that's built into the machine. And you put it right in the... You can be working and breastfeed.
I never would.
It's a pump. I'm sorry.
If I were a listener of this program, I would never expect two grown men to be talking about portable breast pumps on beautiful. A movie podcast. Thank you, John Steinbeck.
I think it's beautiful. My wife's a huge breastfeeding fan.
Oh, and I think that's great. I'm just saying, like, we're a little off. We might be slightly off topic, listeners.
Anyway, final thoughts, Tim, on Lady Bird. This is your moment. Go. And your letter grade.
Well-written script. That's what really shines. Great acting. And... I think it may not have a heavy enough plot point to be Oscar worthy. I think it'll get nominated, but I don't think it has enough oomph. It's still an adolescent coming of age story, and I don't know if it has enough. If that's going to power it through, because I think that with the weaknesses that we both identified, which are fun for a rambling mumblecore movie.
It didn't acknowledge any weaknesses.
Okay. Well, you said that. That like you couldn't identify a plot like to your mom, right? So I think that's where you're going to be struggling. I mean, that's where we can identify plots in other movies. I mean, we talk about themes and stuff, but I think where the weakness is that the coming of age movie. I mean, has that ever won an Oscar?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's a good point.
Maybe I'm missing something.
Uh-huh. Moonlight won an Oscar, but there's so much more
that
going
is,
on.
And that is a coming of age movie, but there's a lot. Yeah, it's a lot more going on. Heavier stuff going on in some ways.
Right. What's your letter grade?
A-.
Okay. Well, I disagree with some of that, Tim, and it's okay. But I love this movie. I love this movie. I honestly have a hard time believing that anything is going to top it this year for me. I think that it's number one on my top 10, and I would be ecstatic if a movie could top it and knock it off, because that would mean that there's something better out there than this. But honestly, folks, this is the one for me. I thought it was delightful from beginning to end. It's probably will go down as my favorite film of the year.
Throw down a little bit here?
Please.
Okay, so when I'm watching Christopher Nolan create a visual masterpiece that
Dunkirk is what he's talking about.
In Dunkirk.
Yes.
It's hard for me to look at this low budget, poor, like mediocre. Oh, no, hold on. It's mediocre cinematography. A beautiful script.
Yeah.
I will agree with that.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to even compare those two and as far as Oscars go.
The emotion that Lady Bird brings is so much more rich than Dunkirk's emotional. Like, Dunkirk is basically missing, like, an emotional connection. I mean, like, you get a few fleeting glimpses, but just like with most of Nolan's work, I mean, it is a very cerebral, technically masterful movie, but, like I laughed and cried in Lady Bird, and I felt virtually nothing emotionally in Dunkirk. That's what I would say, but anyway.
Yeah, I think they're very different films.
Yes.
I guess the thing I would ask would be, which film is a greater achievement?
Oh, well. But which is the overall better film? And for me, it's Lady Bird. Not hands down, but I mean, Dunkirk's up there. I mean, it's like, they're both great movies, but I would give Dunkirk an A-, and Lady Bird gets a solid A for me.
So I think we're not going to agree on this.
That's okay.
And I definitely, that's kind of how I feel about it.
See, yeah,
I wish Lady Bird had been out there in 2003. Obviously, you couldn't do it while it was happening, but
right.
But like, it has that feel of like earlier films like Eternal Sunshine, mm-hmm. and some of the Wes Anderson films. And then what's the other one I was thinking about? It's basically, we didn't talk about it, but the ones that are all scored by the same John Brion or whatever.
John Brion, who did Eternal Sunshine. Yeah.
And he did a bunch of other ones.
He did the score for this movie. And let it be known that there's like a Justin Timberlake song in there at one point. And I saw this really cute thing online that Greta Gerwig personally reached out to Justin Timberlake and asked him if he could, she could use the song in the movie, wrote a personal letter, and it got leaked online. And it was just like the cutest thing about how she grew up listening to this Aww. One song. And like, yeah, I think she was looking for it for free because, yeah, you could go to your studio, but then it's going to be like, you know, $20,000 to do the thing. So
right.
They're on a tight budget.
They're on a budget.
Anyway. So, yes, you heard it here. I don't give out many A's. We've had this conversation. Last year, I was able to hand out 2. The year before that, there was none. But this film gets my first, and who knows, maybe my only, straight A of the year. So Greta Gerwig is a new voice that I am going to be anxiously following. I can't believe this is her debut feature. And I predict Lady Bird will be up for Best Picture, Director, Actress, Supporting Actress, Screenplay, and possibly others. Now, will it win it all? You're right. I mean, the Oscars always have a dramatic sweet spot for dramatic films. And this is a quirky kind of indie comedy-ish, right?
Dramas win.
Right, right. So yeah. It's going to be a tough sell. It's going to win the Golden Globe for Best Comedy. I would bet $1 million on that because that's the
more
beauty
than,
of...
More than Get Out?
I cannot believe Get Out is in the comedy category for Golden Globes. I can't believe it, Tim. What has happened? That is not a comedy. That is, there's nothing funny about that movie.
It's a,
what is happening? I'm so mad. About
satire,
that.
Man. Come on.
Oh, it's not satire.
So this is good because I think we're at a real impasse here.
Yes.
And I think that's more. Hopefully, that's interesting for you guys.
I hope so.
Let us know. Like, do you think that I'm wrong? I want to know.
Write us in. Tell us who's right. podcast@cinemafaith.com is our email address. We will read your comment on air. It'll be fascinating. Do you agree with Tim or do you agree with me? I think we all know.
Is this? I think Laurie Metcalf will be in there. I don't know about, how do you say her name? Saoirse
Ronan.
I don't know about Saoirse Ronan or not.
It's a shoo-in.
She's good, but I definitely think Metcalf will be for supporting.
Yeah.
I think that she, yeah.
By the way, Lady Bird is the first film in Rotten Tomatoes history to stay at 100% after all the critics have been counted. 173 critics at least liked the movie.
3 out of 5.
It gave it a 3 out of 5 rating, you're saying, or a B or above. Right, yes. But all 173 critics counted, 0 critics didn't like it. That's literally unheard of, and it broke a record for Rotten Tomatoes. So,
well, let's keep things in perspective. Who had that record before?
No one.
Toy Story 2.
Was it?
Yeah, so like, come on.
Come
let's,
on. That so cheapens it.
It's not cheap, it's just a fact.
Such a jerk. He's an 8. He's an 8.
I'm sure like Toy Story 2 is a solid A- too.
All right, that's it, man. Lady Bird is playing in a theater near you. Catch it while you can. It's a masterpiece. And it is going to be the talk of the Golden Globes and the Oscars. And you have the opportunity to see it right now. And we know you care about these things. So go see it.
Go see a bunch of movies.
Go see a bunch of movies. December, it's all coming to theaters. So go see them. And next month, we're in a bit of a debate over what podcast to do next month. I think it's our obligation to do Star Wars The Last Jedi for all of you. But Tim thinks that that would be a travesty with all these other Oscar movies coming out. So we're going to have to duke it out. We don't know.
Plus, now that Disney owns Star Wars, are we gonna have to like review a Star Wars movie once a year? Is that like part of how this works now?
Don't get me started on Disney, man. I've read some disturbing articles about them. This is the craziest thing. Disney said that is making these draconian deals with these studios where they have to show their movies in the biggest theater for 30 days. They have to keep it in the same biggest theater of the house. And they get like 65% of the profits. They're just being kind of a bully on the block because they can, right? They own Marvel and Star Wars. They can make the rules. But come on.
So you know what? You should probably boycott those guys and not do a podcast on Star Wars.
That's a good point. We'll see. So we're either doing a podcast on Star Wars or another Oscar movie or maybe both. That's what I'm thinking, is that somehow we're going to combine both. So December is going to be interesting. So that's it. We'll see what December holds. And thanks for listening, everyone. Remember, podcast@cinemafaith.com is our email address. Please rate and subscribe the show. It takes such a short amount of time. You just go to the podcast app on your iPhone and look us up and hit subscribe, or just do a little 5-star rating and say, hey, love the show. That's all you got to say. And that boosts boosts us instantly into a new stratosphere of search results. We would be forever indebted. Please do it.
Please.
Always a pleasure talking film, Tim.
You too, man.
Keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.